Hello and welcome to Spectator Out Loud. Each week we ask a few of our writers to read their piece from the magazine. On this episode, Mary Wakefield tells us how to cure a smartphone addiction. Hannah Tomes reviews the latest production of King Lear. And Cosmo Landisman says he got high recently. First up, Mary Wakefield.
Somehow, I've lost the light phone that I bought to replace the dumb phone that I hoped would break my addiction to the iPhone. The light phone is the latest bit of hipster kit, designed to mimic a smartphone but without the distracting internet connection. I don't know if it works or not, because as I say, I've lost it. And I'm despairing, but not surprised. It's been 3.5 years since I first thought I'd try to escape the iPhone's clutches, and over that time, it's outwitted me, easily and consistently. A crop of articles have appeared recently by journalists who've made the leap and freed themselves from smartphones. I represent another, less admirable demographic. What I can offer you is not a view from the other side, but a cautionary tale. I first became aware of the extent of my habit in the winter of 2018 as I cycled home from work. At each red light, I found myself fumbling for the phone in my pocket, scattering biros, and checking for updates and new messages without having made a conscious decision to do so. I noticed other cyclists doing the same, faces lit up in the evening dark. What were we looking for? What could have changed in the 7 minutes between red light stops? It scared me. I found the screen time monitor. 8 hours a day I was spending on it. The next day, I set about looking for a replacement phone. A dumb phone of the sort I used in my 20s. The iPhone was soon to be a thing of the past, I was quite sure of it. What I hadn't realised then is the extent to which the smartphone, with its constant internet access and array of available apps, had taken charge of my brain. When I took that first Nokia home, I was shocked by the joy I felt at the thought of escape. But quite soon my mind, servant of Apple Inc., produced the idea that I would suffer professionally without constant access to WhatsApp. WhatsApp is only available on smartphones, so no, best not risk it. A year went by. WhatsApp became available on the Nokia Tough, but I had another excuse ready. I said to myself that it was the smartphone keyboard I couldn't do without. It must be available at all times for any important and lengthy thoughts. This is particularly laughable because iPhone destroys lengthy thought. They allow only a distracted sideways crabbing from app to app in search of novelty. But as my will to leave the eye empire became weaker, so the reasons not to leave became more bogus. Why try too hard? She's not going anywhere. When my light phone did arrive with its note-taking capability, I tried to be aware of the feeble excuses my mind produced, as they occurred to me. Transfer to a non-smartphone would be foolish, I thought, dangerous even, because it means a new number which my son's school and my mum will forget. I can't put them in danger. Well, this is a pathetic excuse for an excuse. It's addict thinking. And then I lost the phone. I looked for the missing iPhone in the drawer I keep for things that stab you in the fingertips. I found at the back, when I did look, not one but three old dumb phones lying side by side. Nokia, Mobiwire, Alcatel. Each one a memorial to a past failed attempt to escape. I had forgotten them, or willed myself to forget, because my mind is not any more my own. It's like a sort of feckless cat that's been regularly fed by a wealthy neighbour. Apple, Amazon, Meta. And it acts, for the most part, in their interests. But then this is how the eye trap works. It has tentacles in every cranny of your cerebrum. It offers relief from the stress it itself creates. So the worse you feel about being an iPhone addict, the more you ogle it to feel better. Worried about your screen time? Try a little shopping spree. Amazon one click is always calming. On Monday, Bezos overtook Musk to become the richest man in the world again. In the wake of the light phone fiasco, I've become wily. Like all long-term prisoners, I've taken to watching my captor, studying its ways, and my next step is not another phone. Any eye addicts in your family? Here's the protocol. Go to Settings, Accessibility, Display and Text Sign, and find, buried in there, the colour filters. Turn them on. Instantly, all the bright buttons and logos disappear. All the tools you think you need remain. Photos, maps, Instagram, WhatsApp, bank, but all in delicious shades of sludge. It's repulsive. I'm delighted. I paw pitifully at the screen, but without colour, there's only a fraction of the usual hit. Who wants to scroll through a slug-coloured Instagram? Even I can't one-click by what I can't properly see. WhatsApp, too, has lost its savour. When the app isn't its trademark green, it becomes much less important to check your messages, I find. When there's no blue tick to signify a message has been read, I'm just less interested. There's been so much written about the brain's craving for newness and the neuroscience of notifications. But how much of a smartphone's terrible pull is contained in its hyper-real backlit colours, each bright app the product of billions of pounds worth of research? I looked for official research, but found only one tangentially related report from Nature. Blue light exposure, which is screen light, shortens the lifespan of fruit flies and causes brain neurodegeneration and accelerated ageing. So I quickly stopped reading that. But the preliminary results of my own single-person study are almost as alarming. Once I'd turned the iPhone a dismal grey and looked up at the non-screen world, it was as if the colour from the phone had suddenly bled back into reality. Everything was brighter and lovelier, not metaphorically, but quite literally. Subtle shades I hadn't noticed were missing had returned. Muted greys, browns and blues. The infinite variety of what should be the real world spectrum. This phenomenon has scared me so much, I firmly resolved to use what remains of my willpower to try to continue in black and white on the iPhone. And let's see how long that lasts.
That was Mary Wakefield, and now Hannah Tomes.
Yael Farber's production of King Lear at the Almeida Theatre is imbued with an undercurrent of tension that feels as if it's constantly on the edge of exploding into violence. It's not her first crack at Shakespeare. In 2001, she adapted Julius Caesar, and she directed Hamlet at the Gate in Dublin in 2018 and Macbeth at the Almeida in 2021. But I'd be willing to bet it's her most virulent. The opening scene, a swanky press conference that could have been lifted straight from an episode of Succession, neatly sets the tone of the snippy relationships. Danny Sapani's Lear is a man who isn't used to hearing the word no, flying into a terrifying rage and scattering microphones across the stage with a powerful backhand when Cordelia, Gloria Obiano, refuses to take part in this circus of public flattery. Regan, Faith Amoli, and Goneril, Akia Henry, are the dutiful daughters, each assuring their ailing father and the implied audience of the conference of their devotion to him, while at the same time vying with each other for a larger part of his kingdom. Lear's dislike for them both is clear, as is the filial warmth between Lear and Cordelia, which makes his disowning of her all the more heart-wrenching and his descent all the more tender. Sapani flits between wounded father, humiliated ruler, and spiky, unpredictable caged lion hemmed in at every turn, and he's utterly believable in each iteration. His raging indignation at being stripped of his virility and power, his crushing acceptance of age, "They told me I was everything, 'tis a lie, I am not ague-proof." His return to a childlike state, near naked on the heath, is devastating. But if Sapani is a brilliant Lear, Clark Peters is an even better fool. Peters, who's best known for playing Detective Lester Freeman in The Wire, has an easy way about him, delivering hard truths with both care and humour. It's clear how valuable this fool is to this Lear, and, straying from Shakespeare's original work, Farber gives him some of the closing lines of the play, usually attributed to Edgar. "Speak what we feel, not what we ought to say." He delivers them with a lyricism that leads perfectly into the cast rendition of Dylan's "A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall" to finish. It sounds gimmicky, but it's chilling and beautiful. Merle Hensel's set, which could seem spartan in the hands of a less engaged cast, is so powerful and well-imagined that it's almost a character in its own right. Sparsely populated with chairs, a rug and a piano, the stage is lined at the back by a curtain of hanging chains. The shielded second space this creates is used to great effect when Edmund, a lusty, chain-smoking, manipulative, and often very funny Fra Fee, shares a passionate kiss with one sister, quite literally behind the other's back. But it's in the scenes on the heath where the staging really comes into its own. With the chain set swinging, Edgar, once a nerdy rake bullied by his brother Edmund, but by now poor Tom, runs around the space with a long cape of plastic sheeting, topped with dirt, trailing behind him. He cakes the floor with it. When I step outside at the interval, there's mud everywhere, so much so that it's almost impossible to tell where the world of Lear ends and reality begins. I hope the cleaners get a pay rise. There's not an actor on the stage who doesn't earn their place. Matthew Tennyson puts in a strong shift as Edgar, an often thankless role as he flits between meekness and madness. Amolly and Henry are vicious as Regan and Goneril, turning against their father with thinly veiled greed. Henry is especially devilish when she encourages the Duke of Cornwall, Edward Davis, to pluck out Gloucester's eyes. It's truly gruesome. And Obiano is an affecting Cordelia, truthful to a fault. She also has one hell of a singing voice. Farber has called King Lear the Mount Everest of theatre. This towering production leaves Everest in its shadow.
That was Hannah Tomes. And finally, Cosmo Landesman.
Recently, I got very stoned. I haven't been that stoned since I was at Woodstock. Or was it the first Glastonbury Festival? Or maybe Bob Dylan at the Isle of Wight? I can't remember, but that's dope for you. The curious thing is, I don't take drugs anymore. I hate getting high. It's like your brain is seasick. But there I was at a party, and the hostess offered me an apple-flavored, cannabis-infused gummy. Without thinking, I swallowed it, just as if I'd been offered a canapé. As soon as I did, I started to panic. What had I done? Why had I done it? Any minute I was going to start hallucinating and then take off all my clothes and do frenzied nude hippie dancing before falling to my knees and weeping and crying out, "Mother, where are you?" Something like this once actually happened to me. People at the party would be frightened. They would call an ambulance or maybe the police. Then the men in white coats would come and take me away, ha ha. I was freaking out even before the drugs took effect. Then the voice of my young bohemian self said, "For heaven's sakes, relax. Can't you just let your hair down and have a little fun for once, you old square? You've become so uptight and boring. Go wild. You're such a puritanical wuss. Do you think Keith Richard goes, 'Oh, dear me, I've done a gummy. Mick, help me, please.' Cosmo, what harm can one little gummy do?" I found out about 40 minutes later when a friend who had also eaten one passed out and fell to the floor, head first. She was unconscious for a few minutes. I discovered another gummy guy sitting on his own in a dark room, staring intensely at his feet, quivering with paranoia. By now, the stone hostess had gone to bed, unable to string a coherent sentence together. And me? I felt as if I was about to pass out too. Someone later told me I ran out of the party yelling, "Help, I'm going to die." I had a very druggy adolescence. My parents were old bohemians. For Christmas, they regularly gave my brother and me a lump of hashish, cigarette papers, and a packet of fags. As a family, we get stoned and watch the Christmas edition of the Top of the Pops. And even though I quit taking drugs decades ago, they've always been part of the world I've moved in and identified with. Artists, writers, poets, musicians, and crazies, these are my people. Or at least, they used to be. Nowadays, when I'm in some Soho dive or at a party of people dipping their fingers into little bags of this and that, I feel I don't belong. First of all, everyone is stoned on something. Mushroom, hashish, MDMA, and coke. Though the use of cocaine, the worst drug in the world, is, I suspect, in decline. But psychedelics, LSD, psilocybin, are growing in popularity. I try to warn my young friends that taking LSD is like playing Russian roulette with your brain. They don't listen. Everyone I know drinks, takes drugs, and stays up to 3 or 4 in the morning, except me. These are fun people. Bright, creative, talented. I love them. But after a certain point in a drug or drink-fueled evening, even the best and the brightest become unbearable. As Sartre never said, hell is other people smashed out of their heads. The drunk and the stoned blur into one and the same creature, the intoxicated boor. Both are unbearable in their own ways. The drunk batters you down with tedious repetition, the stone with goofy whimsy presented as great wisdom. I feel like one of those older gay men who come out of the closet after a lifetime of pretending to be straight. After a lifetime of pretending to be a wild boho, I want to come out of my closet and declare to the world, I'm actually a nice bourgeois boy at heart. There, I've said it. Yes, I want to have a super clean and tidy flat that smells of furniture polish and possess a cupboard of beautifully ironed linen. I no longer want to discuss the dialectics of modern art or the poetics of transgression. I want to exchange tips on dealing with nasty stains, unpleasant odors, pension plans, and playing bridge. In short, I want to discover, as Louis Bunuel put it, ironically, the discreet charm of the bourgeoisie. The thing is, the bourgeoisie aren't what they used to be. Once they were sober and serious and sensible, now they're just like bohemians. For starters, they're all stoned out of their heads. At least the ones I meet are. I recently sat in the mansion of a very hard-working and successful entrepreneur, who once upon a time would, on my arrival, have offered me a glass of the finest and most expensive champagne. Instead, he offers me a hit on his bong. And I know a man who's very rich, very successful, and he not only has his own plane, his own cook, and his own island, but he now has his very own special joint roller. That's right, a man whose only job is to construct perfectly rolled spliffs. Of course, I plan to keep my crazy boho friends. Fortunately for me, they're usually too stoned or pissed to know how boring I am now I've gone straight. One thing I am certain of, the days of being a gummy dummy are definitely over.
That was Cosmo, and that's it for this episode of Spectator Out Loud. Thank you very much for listening, and do join us again next week.